Everybody have your Bible open to Titus chapter 3, please. And we begin looking today at the difference it makes when people have been trained by the grace of God. Most people don't like to engage in things that activities or exercises or endeavors that they are afraid somehow makes no difference or make no difference. And I think if you were being trained in a school, for example, a university, a school, a training course, or whatever, and you had the view that this training was going to be of absolutely no different, no use in your life, and it would make absolutely no difference, it would be pretty hard to endure at that, to stay with it, to put your best effort into it. And that principle would be true with regard to our view of faith in Christ as well. If we had the idea that that God's training of us through His grace, as we have read in Titus 2, verses 11 through 14, was not going to make any difference, then first, we would be misled by that idea. But secondly, it would be hard to maintain the energy it takes to be different from the culture that we live in. Now, Paul has been saying to Titus, as we have read this letter, that he wants Titus to help the Christians on the island of Crete to remember to engage in good works. Now notice especially the contrast we have seen in chapter 1, verse 16, and chapter 2, and verse 14. Those two verses again, we read them last week, and I want you to see the contrast that's here. The end of verse 16 of chapter 1, the end of verse 14 of chapter 2. Becky, get the chapter 1 for us, if you would.
The end of it?
Yes, verse 16.
They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny Him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed.
All right, worthless for any good deed, unfit for any good work, incapable of any kind of good work, if you think of it that way. On the other hand, look at those who are trained by God's grace or who are taught by God's grace, verse 12 of chapter 2. Let's read verse 14. Brendan, get that for us, please.
Who gave Himself to us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for Himself a people for His own possession, zealous for good deeds.
All right. Now, notice in this case, these are not only people who are capable of good works, but they are zealous for them. So, the transition or the contrast here from unfit for any good work to zealous for every good work is what we want to see. Now, the question comes, if you're going to teach somebody to be zealous for good works and to be fit for good works, where do you start? How do you teach somebody to be ready for or zealous for every good work? And that's kind of where we are in our text here now at the beginning of chapter 3. These are the kinds of things now, if you look at 2:15, the last verse of chapter 2, that Titus is supposed to exhort and rebuke and declare with all authority. And what we're going to see here is the contrast between what one is because of Christ and what one may have been before Christ and what one may still be outside of Christ. You'll see that contrast. And let's start, I think, with verse 1 of chapter 3. I want to get the last phrase in this, and then we will look at the other phrases in it. Chapter 3, verse 1. Shauna, you got it open there. Would you mind to read that?
Mm-hmm. Remind the people to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready to do whatever is good.
All right. Now, Notice the last phrase of that verse is to be ready for every good work. Does everybody see that? This is the same phrase that we've been following, chapter 1:16, chapter 2:14, and now 3:1. We've gone from unfit for, to zealous for, to ready for every good work. That's the transition that we are to make. Now, the word for, put them in mind, chapter 3:1. Put them in mind. This is a function of the teaching of the Lord's Word in a culture where people have not been accustomed to doing the Lord's will. What do you think of when you find that phrase? Put them in mind. It will be translated in some cases, remind. What is he saying? Why do you need to be put in mind or reminded to or caused to remember something? All right, old habits are hard to break. That's a good way of saying it. And when those old habits are reinforced by the culture from which you came, and when those old habits are a way of life among that popular culture, it is easy to forget, isn't it? And the one of the lessons for us is that in a situation where we are like the people in Athens on Mars Hill, always wanting to hear or to teach something new, it's important for us to recall from time to time that the thing that maybe what we need is not something new, but to be reminded of the importance of what we already know. Remind, put them in mind, remind, call them, cause them to remember. Now look at the list of things that we are to be put in mind to do. This is what we are now in Christ, and I'll complete the contrast here in a minute. First, to be subject. We've run across this phrase already twice in this letter. It was used with regard to younger women in chapter 2 and verse 5. And it was used, let's see, which verse before this? It was used, which verse? Verse 9, okay. Verse 9. Chapter 2. So this is not a new term for us, and we pointed out that this is a voluntary submission. This is something that a person does out of dignity and out of choice. Who does he say that Christians are to be submissive to here?
Rulers and authorities.
All right, rulers and authorities. Now, we would do well probably to think about what we're talking about here. Rulers and authorities. Who are we talking about with those two words?
Government.
All right, we're talking about civil authorities, as we would call them here, or governmental authorities, the powers that be, as they are called in other places. Who really has all authority? Christ does. The Lord does. Authority, of course, is inherent in God's own nature because He is God. So that there would be authorities would presume that it was derived from whence? From God. All right. So these powers that be are those who in the providence of God have been charged with the responsibility of ruling or of governing. What is the function that God intends for those in this situation? Is this saying that rulers and authorities always do what God wants them to do? No, it sure isn't, is it? It's not saying that at all. Eddie?
1 Peter 2:13 has a good answer
for that. All right, so does Romans 13.
Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king or supreme.
Okay, and go ahead and read the verses surrounding.
Or to governors, or to those who are sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good.
All right, think carefully about what Eddie just read about the proper what should be expected by people who believe in the providential rule of God. Of rulers and authorities. What did that last verse, 1 Peter 2 and verse 15 say? Verse 14 maybe. As governors sent by him to do what?
Punishment of evil doers.
All right. To punish evil. And?
For the praise of those who do good.
All right, for the praise of good. That is the main function of governing authority under the providence of God. Now, of course, as we mentioned a moment ago, there have been so many cases throughout history of people who have left their God-given realm and not functioned as God wanted them to. There have been rulers who tried to destroy good and who sought to do evil and to reward evil, and they all got away with it. They all lasted, right? If God rules in the kingdoms of men, then it means that eventually those authorities are responsible to God and that He deals with them. It's one of the great values of reading the Old Testament with regard to God's rule of the nations. Look at Romans 13 while we're on this this point here. This bears a lot more reading and thinking than we're going to give it here this morning. But I want you to notice in Romans 13, verse 1 and following, really 1 through 7, this same theme is addressed at more length by Paul. And it's interesting that in writing this letter, he's writing to people, in Christians in Rome, where, of course, the emperor had his throne. He tells them again, verse 1, to be subject to these governing authorities. And then verse 1 he says, for there is no authority but from God. And those authorities that exist, I'm paraphrasing a bit here, have been
established
or instituted or appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists these authorities resist what God has appointed. And then verse 3, the beginning. Michelle, do you mind to read for us there? Romans 13:3, starting.
For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same.
Go ahead.
For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil.
All right. Now, if you listen closely to what Michelle just read, you notice that that in verse 4, these rulers are intended to be God's servants for good, and that they're intended to be God's servants at the end of the verse to execute God's wrath on the wrongdoer. So the function of these authorities in civil authorities in God's providential intention is to maintain good order, and they do so in the two ways that we also find in 1 Peter. So both Paul and Peter are together on this idea. Now, is a Christian obligated to be subject to governing authorities in cases, in individual cases, where those governing authorities or those rulers require the Christian to do what is morally wrong or punish Christians for doing what is a spiritual obligation before God? My question may be strung out too much for you to see what I'm getting at.
What did Peter say in Acts?
Acts 5 and verse 29 would be a good verse for us to think about. Someone read it for us.
And Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than man."
All right, so there, and in that case, if you read the context, what the temple authorities in that case were trying to do is to forbid Peter and the other apostles from saying anything more in the name of Christ. However, they already had a command from Christ to preach the gospel. So they were being forbidden to do what the Lord had already obligated them to do, and they could not, in that case, obey man instead of God. Todd, what were you going to say?
Well, then back in 1 Peter 2, the 15 says, "For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolishness."
Yeah, and that is something that's a major concern in Titus too, about not allowing the gospel to be blasphemed or spoken against or reproached at all. The presence of Christians is intended always to be an advantage to any society. And if Christians are to be subject to rulers and authorities, but not to be required to do evil or to be forbidden from doing well, then in what sense are Christians to be subject to those authorities or powers that be? Give me some ways in which... Okay, Becky?
Well, here in Titus, it's saying don't be contentious, be gentle.
All right.
Tell them, you know, the Christian's lifestyle and the way that we make our decisions.
All right. So the way of life, Becky is saying, the entire way of life is to be one that is to fit this mode here. If someone would... turn over for us to 1 Timothy 2, and we'll read verse 1 and 2 in just a second. I want to think about some other things while we're looking that up. Now, what are some of the other specific ways in which we are to be subject to the authorities that be? Both Peter and Paul talk about this one. For example... Alright, both Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 talk about honor to whom honor, and it's dealing there with payment of taxes and the meeting of obligations as a citizen and that type of thing. The Christian is not out to overthrow the culture, overthrow the society, overthrow the order that God has allowed to exist in the society. The obedience to any laws that do not require the Christian to do evil. For example, in the book of Revelation, where the Christians were trying to be forced to burn incense and to say that Caesar is Lord, that was a kind of law they could not obey. Why?
Caesar was not,
and never has been or will be Lord. Christ is. So the Christian in that way would not be able to do such a thing. But to obey the laws, to be subject to the rulers, to have a way of life that is a blessing to the community and so forth, all of that is an important part of this. And then look at 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 and 2. Jan, would you read that, please?
"First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, in order that we may live a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity."
All right, now think about this. The Christian prays for those who are in high positions, but the object of the Christian's prayer is that we might be able to live a life of peace and of quietness, where godliness and dignity is practiced, And the object of that, if you look at verses 3 and 4, is that people might be saved. The gospel might be taught, and people might be saved. In our society, of course, that means that when elections and such come along, you and I as Christians are going to have a different ultimate goal in mind than the culture at large will. While arguments go on about what kind of programs will be presented and what kind of tax law will be enacted and what kind of foreign policy will be pursued, etc., the Christian's main concern will be, will this allow for a godly and dignified way of life that will be conducive to people hearing the gospel and being saved? That's the main urgent thing that is to be in the Christian mind. All right. Without making the whole class about the place of civil order in God's plan, just remember that Daniel 4 and verse 35 and restatements of that same thing make the point that the Most High God does what? Rules in the kingdoms of men. That's what was said in Daniel's day. And God hasn't changed. He still does, even though it may be, we never see it happening at the moment. We believe it still is going. So we view this as cooperating with God. I'd say it that way. Anyone else with a comment about this before we move on? All right. We've settled in just 20 minutes here. All questions about the role of government here. I know that's a major accomplishment here. All right. So, okay. Anybody else?
Is this a direction that it's our responsibility to participate?
Okay.
That we should vote?
All right.
That we should study the issues and be concerned All right. about what the government's
That's a very good question. Yvonne's question, part of what I hear in it is a long-standing discussion. I ran across a professor that I had in my college days who maintained that a Christian should not vote or participate at all. I read this much more like what you just said. I think this is telling us that be a Christian citizen. Be involved. Be aware. Inform yourself. Be a partner with God in being active in His providential rule in the kingdom of men. And take your Christian values with you as you do so. That's what I see in this. And I think that would be the best way to read it. You'd be subject to them, regard them with respect, but still fill your place as a Christian in the society. And the rest of the statements of this passage, I think, might help us to think about that a bit. Okay, look at what he says now. To be subject, and then the next verb here is to be what?
Obedient.
All right, to be obedient. This is talking now about not just an incidental or a case by case situation, but a general mindset, as a general temperament or a general way of life. The Christian is someone who is law-abiding, who has a spirit about him in which he is not someone who is to be regarded as a rebel by nature, but as someone who looks for opportunity to show the Spirit of Christ in his daily life. And the Spirit of Christ is one, Philippians 2, remember? He became obedient even unto death. That's right. So That the general idea would be that. And then to be, what does he say? Be ready for every good work. We've commented about this a bit, but what strikes you about this phraseology here? I'm kind of following it this way. What about the mindset or about the general temperament of an individual does that suggest to you? All right, this is someone who has his eye open for the opportunity to do good. This is someone who is ready to get up out of the easy chair and living room and to be involved in life and helping and doing what is good and right, eager for the opportunity to represent the cause of goodness in the world. I think that would be a part of this. Then let's move on to verse 2 and look at what he says here. What does he say first in verse 2?
To malign no one.
All right, to malign no one, to speak evil of no one. Let me put it with the words that Tim used, to malign or to speak evil of no one. All right, that is quite a charge, isn't it? And you'll notice that there has to be some guidance to this. This is the same writer who just said, if you back up in chapter 1, verse 10, there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers, and deceivers. That verse said, they teach for shameful gain what they ought not to teach. Verse 11 said, he goes ahead and talks about the character of these people. So it's not saying that evil cannot be recognized. It's not saying that wrong cannot be rebuked. Look at chapter 2, verse 15. Remember he said, rebuke with all authority, let no one disregard you. So there's some things this cannot be saying. I take it that we're dealing again with the general temperament of the Christian life and the spirit of the Christian in which he does not make a habit of belittling, running down, dwelling on the negative of any individual. Christian is not known for the pugnacious spirit running down and finding fault with in any situation. All right. Then he says at verse 2 next, what? I'm going to get half of our contrast here today only, looks like. Avoid what?
Uncontentious.
All right. Be uncontentious. Avoid quarreling is the way I'm going to put it. This is something that Paul brings up four times in the pastoral epistles. And one of the writers, I read Brother Wayne Jackson on the definition of these words, and he pointed out that this is the kind of person who, if he can't find a fight to get involved in, he'll start one, is the way he said it. And avoid that kind of a spirit. Now, it's not, again, it can't be, look, I'll just get along with anything. I'll never challenge wrong. That can't be what he's saying. But, look, remember Paul will say in these letters, there are endless, meaningless myths. There are arguments about words that mean nothing. There are contentious attitudes and spirits that should not be maintained. Avoid that. Then next, to be what?
Gentle.
Gentle. All right. This is This is the kind of a gentleness that involves a certain strength. Sometimes meekness is involved with this, meaning strength under control. This is also the sweet spirit of kindness that's involved in this. It is the thoughtfulness that undergirds this kind of activity, this kind of treatment of other people. And then I like the way the English Standard Version translates this next phrase here. Show perfect courtesy, it says, to all people. How else is that translated? How is it in the Nanny and the NEB? How is it translated?
Showing every consideration.
Showing every consideration? That's how it is? How is it in the American Standard, Brandon?
Showing all meekness.
Showing all meekness? All right. Any other ways in which it gets phrased? This is a hard term to translate. All humility. All right. You can see from the way that the term is translated that it's hard to gather it up in one English term. But the idea of a kind of consideration, humility, and so forth that allows courtesy to take place is important. Now, where might this be practiced? How about in a checkout line at a grocery store? How about at a stop sign? How about in changing lanes? How about in saying please and thank you, yes ma'am and no ma'am, you go first, let me hold the door for you, pick up the paper. I think that the overlooked way in which society depends on Christian spirit is just in this thought of courtesy here. And courtesy is the first and most basic and most obvious sign of respect. And when you see a culture becoming cruder and ruder, if those are even terms, then you can see a culture that eventually will be in trouble. And isn't it interesting that when Paul starts talking about the effect that Christians ought to have in a culture, that he approaches it in these kinds of ways. Be subject, yes, but with this spirit. Obedient, preparedness for good works, not speaking evil, avoiding quarreling. In other words, you're not rabble-rousers in that sense. You're gentle toward people, and you try to practice a certain kind of courtesy in family life and community life. Danny?
I find it interesting the New English Bible says show forbearance and a consistently gentle disposition.
All right. Forbearance and a consistently gentle disposition. I brought these versions so we could compare the words here. I think, by the way, if there is any value to the various versions, it's to compare the meanings of words in lists like this, more than trying to discover any doctrinal meaning, but these kinds of words are important.
Okay? Courtesy is something, though, that has to be taught. We're not...
It has to have a basis, doesn't it?
I've watched one of my cousin's children. They say thank you when the waitress gives them a drink. Because mom and dad do it, you know. My cousin said the other day she didn't see an elderly man coming to the library, but Robert did, so he stopped and ran back and opened the door.
And Robert is seven.
That's because they've been taught it, not because they just happened to be different than other kids.
Yeah. Taught by example, too. Just told.
Right.
Shown, modeled.
They see it every day.
Your point's well made, because I remember learning those lessons as even from my father, but then when I became a police officer, I had to address the issue that I was sitting in church on Sunday But on Monday morning, I had every right to make the handcuffs too tight if I wanted to. And I had to deal with that. I had to confront those issues.
You have to
Being rude just because I had the badge and the gun and the authority did not give me the right to be rude. And I remember the example that I was taught by my own father, that you're kind and you're courteous to other people, even when you don't necessarily want to be, because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and because it's the Christian thing to do here as well. So you think about this. I've kept you past time, by the way. I know it's a surprise to you, but we got started late. Thank you guys for being with us. This is the Christians can add this to a culture, and it's much needed today. Thank you all for being with us.